the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. The information and ideas presented on this show are for informational purposes only. Please consult a business continuity, security, or disaster recovery professional before implementing any plans or ideas discussed on this show. The implementation of any protocol is at the sole discretion and responsibility of our listeners.
Is your business ready for a disaster, or are you prepared for anything? No matter the industry or structure of your organization, chances are there could be room for improvement regarding your survival business practices. This is Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. Your host is Pamela Hill. Join us today as we study what's working in business preparedness and what's still left to do. Here is Pamela Hill.
Hello and welcome to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. I'm your host, Pam Hill, and the principal of Risk Partners Alliance. Today, we are continuing the personal safety series by talking about the innate skills each of us have, but many don't use to our advantage to either help keep us safe or sometimes even make good life decisions. And those skills are instinct and intuition. A lot of us are embarrassed to say we follow our hunches or gut feeling about things, and we often mistrust the subtle cues our instincts send to us. Consequently, we can diminish our capacity to leverage that power in all aspects of our lives, not just our safety. Did you realize that studies show that only 20% of our brain is dedicated to conscious thought at any given time? The other 80% is dedicated to unconscious thought, which is the realm of what we're talking about today. When Dr. Schran, the psychiatrist who joined us in the Outsmarting Anger episode, mentioned that our brains complete a risk assessment of people, places, and things in 39 milliseconds, I knew we had to do an episode on instinct and intuition, and that's our focus today. And we are so lucky to have with us today Carol Ward, who is a licensed clinical social worker and author of the fabulous book, Find Your Inner Voice, Using Instinct and Intuition Through the Mind-Body Connection. And our great friend of the show, Nicole Sundine from Realistic Safety Solutions. We're talking about how we can recognize and get in touch with our instinct and intuition and use it to enhance our personal safety. So first, let me introduce these fabulous guests. Carol Ward is a motivational speaker, a therapist, and a confidence expert. Carol speaks professionally in the areas of wellness and communication and is the author of the Find Your Inner Voice book I mentioned earlier, but also the book called Worried Sick, Break Free from Chronic Worry to Achieve Mental and Physical Health. Carol conducts presentations for many, many clients, such as the Clinton Global Initiative and the American Business Women's Association. She's appeared on CNN, NBC, Fox News, and ABC. Carol has been featured as a psychological and communications expert in such publications as U.S. News and World Reporter, the Wall Street Journal, and Oprah.com, to name a few. She also recently gave a TED Talk, which you can find on her website, and we're going to get that address in a little while. And then, of course, the wonderful Nicole Sundine is the founder of Realistic Safety Solutions and the author of the book Realistic Safety Strategies for Women. Nicole has been an advocate for the rights of crime victims for 25 years. During her law enforcement career, she led the victim assistance unit, working with thousands of crime victims, learning about the dynamics that led to their victimization. And a lot of what she learned is directly related to today's topic. As you know, Nicole's been on the last two episodes teaching us how to use every weapon we have available to help keep us safe. So it's only natural she's on this episode as well, talking about instinct and intuition, two of our biggest weapons. So welcome to the show, Carol and Nicole.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pam.
Great to have you guys here. So let's get started. Carol, I'd like to start with you because your book does such a great job of really describing what instinct and intuition is, what the inner voice is, and kind of what it feels like. So let's start there as a baseline. What is the difference between instinct, intuition, and what is that inner voice?
Well, you know, I always like to separate those two words out, instinct and intuition, though people use them interchangeably, and that's fine. But I focus on instinct and name it as our biological system of self-care. It's really that physiological system that we're born with that helps us discern what feels safe and what feels dangerous or what feels pleasurable and what feels painful. It's a very physical reaction within the body. And intuition is something, it's almost an outside-in feeling or sensation. It doesn't necessarily make logical sense when we're thinking of a friend and then they call us, or if we're thinking of someone and then they appear around the corner. But I do believe anchoring both to how you feel physically, which is what the basis of what my work is about, helps you access both.
And how does it actually physically feel? Like, where do we feel it? How do we feel it? Is it a tingle? Is it a quiet voice in our head?
I think it's all of the above, but I do think people describe it. There's some common areas that people describe, instinct and intuition. Often the phrase the gut feeling, they feel a sensation in the stomach. Some people feel something on the back of their neck, often in the upper chest. Some people also describe their hands getting tingly or their forehead right between their eyebrows getting a sensation that they need to pay attention to. And when I talk about that inner voice, Pam, it's really that it can be verbal or nonverbal. It's just this sensation. Sometimes it's words that says you need to pay attention. Pay attention in this moment. Something feels off. And it's registering physically.
Okay, so there is really, truly a physicality to it. And I think that's important for people to know because it's almost like if people aren't acting on it, they're kind of waiting for it to really show up in a really, significant way. So sometimes I get tingles in my hands. I get not so much the gut feeling, but that feeling in my shoulders and my neck that, you know, really something is going on. So I think that's really critically important. One of the things that I was kind of curious about is, does instinct and stress or instinct or intuition and stress, do those feel the same in the body or are they different?
Well, that's a great question. You know, stress is often this adrenalized state. We feel very hyper physically and we feel hyped up. People, you know, when they talk about stress, they're like, oh, I feel so stressed. And they even speak in a heightened way. But I've had people tell me that instinct can have that alertness, but it also can have a feeling of things slowing down. It's not necessarily a feeling of feeling rushed, but it's more of a sense of heightened awareness. So stress actually, I think, can work against us as far as instinct and intuition. When we're stressed, we tend to be scattered, in my opinion, and we're not so focused on those very specific physical sensations.
Okay. And one thing I really want to mention that in Carol's book, she doesn't just talk about safety. She talks about using instinct and intuition as, a guidance, that mind-body connection as guidance for, you know, careers, for relationships, for a lot of different things, and has fabulous exercises, which she's going to talk about a little bit later. So there's a lot of really great information in there, about a lot of things other than just, physical safety. So Nicole, I'd like to switch to you because instinct is throughout your entire book, and it is so critical for personal safety. You know, it's so critical as a fact that you have deemed it as one of your key principles in your book. Can you explain that?
I did. You know, Pam, as a police officer, I face threats to my personal safety every day. So it didn't take long for me to learn that the earlier I was able to detect and identify a threat, the more efficient and effective I was at neutralizing that threat because I had created more reaction time, which in turn equated to more options. So since instinct is the first step in the threat assessment process, it's a critical component of personal protection for all of us, really.
I think right, and how does that show up?
How does it show up?
Mm-hmm.
Really the same ways that Carol described. For me, instinct sort of takes the shape of the physical symptoms and the sensations that she described, the bodily sensations that you feel. And instinct lets me know that I'm in danger, but it doesn't really elaborate or identify the source of the threat. So in my experience, intuition starts where instinct stops, and I usually feel that in the form of hesitation or doubt, maybe apprehension, maybe even disturbing images and persistent thoughts that are directly connected to the person who poses a threat to me. So these feelings may occur when I think of that person or talk with that person or come in contact with that person in some way. The easiest way for me to describe how instinct and intuition work cooperatively anyway in personal safety is that instinct detects danger, but intuition elaborates and sort of identifies the source of that danger.
Okay. So we get this feeling, it's kind of a nagging, you know, thing, and sometimes that follow through is where we can kind of get, you know, tied up. In the Gavin DeBecker book, The Gift of Fear, he talks about the fact that intuition is a gift and knowledge is a process. Carol, just out of curiosity, because you're a psychologist, if intuition is a gift and knowledge is a process, why the heck don't we honor that gift more?
Well, you know, that's something that I'm always dealing with clients and patients, which people sit opposite me and they say things like, you know, I knew it, I knew I shouldn't have, and they whatever that thing is, gone out on a second date, or I shouldn't have taken that opportunity, it felt wrong to me. Most of the times what gets in the way, because I want to say I'm a big fan of the brain, I really love the brain, but often we are overly dependent on what the brain is telling us. And what I mean by that is, more specifically, is often we are led by messages that we've internalized over the years from growing up, and those messages may not be accurate. Those messages might be something like, be polite, be a good girl, don't go against the grain, don't make waves. And so we might have a gut feeling about something, but if there's a split between body and mind, if they aren't in sync, we then allow the brain to take over with that old conditioning, those old messages, which then overrides what the gut is saying. And my focus of my work is really to get those two parts of ourselves in dialogue, linked up together so that they can work together.
And that's critically important. And again, in your book, you have, you know, so many wonderful exercises that we can actually, you know, that you can actually go through. So we're just about at commercial break. So I'm going to take a break. But when we get back, Carol, I'd like to talk about kind of how we live our lives nowadays, how busy we are, and how we communicate really differently, now than how we used to even, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So, when we come back, we're going to talk about this. This is Fear is Negotiable. And this is Pam Hill. I'm here with Carol Ward, Nicole Sundin, and we will be right back.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/voiceamerica or search for us at keyword Voice America.
From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help. When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with the incomparable Carol Ward and Nicole Sundine, and we are talking about intuition and instinct. So again, Carol, I want to just finish up this one question. If intuition is a gift and knowledge is a process, why don't we honor it more? Can you speak to the sheer busyness of our lives? This has to change the way that we are connected to our bodies and what our bodies are trying to tell us.
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, you know, being busy is almost like a badge of honor these days, but I've found that it really can work against us in terms of this specific topic, personal safety and making the best decisions that we want to make in our lives. And when I have people come into my office, you know, sometimes they're just bouncing off the ceiling. They're so stressed. They're so anxious. And they can't focus in or make a decision that feels right to them on an instinctive and intuitive level. But when they have the opportunity to calm down, oh, my gosh, the information that they can pick up and tune into starts to come to the surface. So it really helps us to start carving out even 5 minutes, 10 minutes to start to pay attention to what we really want and need in life. And I tell people sometimes that means when you're sitting in an office or on the train or waiting to pick up your kids, just sitting and calming down and then starting to ask a series of simple questions, starting with what am I feeling and what do I need? And that can start to give answers.
You know, what's interesting about that is I've often told, I've been in the middle of a lot of disasters with clients, and one of the things that I always tell them is quiet the noise. You have to quiet the noise going on around you because people are coming at you so quickly to be able to get a sense of the right thing to do, because you probably know what the right thing is to do. You just can't hear it.
Yeah.
And so I just was really excited to read this part, in your book, because I think that that's so critically important. One of the things I am kind of curious, just from a purely psychological standpoint. Study after study of past crises, and there are groups of people who do nothing but study disasters and crises, have shown that we would rather underreact than overreact and risk social embarrassment. So sociologically, psychologically, Carol, why do you think we'd rather go along to get along than raise an issue when we see it? Why do we remain silent?
In my experience, people are very, very concerned with being judged or being embarrassed or being shamed on some level. And again, usually this has roots that go way back into upbringing, but even if you had a wonderful childhood, some people start to get messages when they get to high school and college and start to move into the business world about how one is supposed to react. And what happens is if we override or go against what our natural impulse is to respond to a certain situation, we start to train ourselves to freeze, to not respond. And over time, that conditions us to be very, very polite. That's when I was talking about those messages in our minds of how we should behave. And I've had people talk about being in very stressful situations. I'm sure you and Nicole have had these situations too, where they sit in absolute stillness. They shut down basically when you would think they were to react a different way. And that comes from conditioning and from societal messages.
So a lot of different things going on. Carol, just out of curiosity, you think that's worse with women, men, or do you think there's a difference?
I do think it's worse with women. That is my experience. I can't give you the statistics. I can only go with what I've experienced in my practice and in workshops. I have noticed that women tend to be trained to work collaboratively, and sometimes that means allowing others to go ahead or allowing others to impose upon them instead of standing up for themselves, which I know the both of you do training in, and really speaking out and saying, no, that doesn't feel right. There's still this tendency to be polite. And another thing, Pam, I think it's important to bring up, there is research done that if someone has had a traumatic childhood or a childhood where the reality of what they felt was, they were told that what they felt was not accurate even though they were feeling it, they tend to have a delayed reaction. So they'll feel this, that something's wrong, but they won't react because for so many years they were taught that what they felt was not accurate, so they tend to second guess.
That's a critically important point. And Nicole, I know I'm kind of throwing you a curveball here, but my guess is you've probably seen that in your victim advocacy.
Oh, absolutely. I've done work with a therapist out of Colorado around those issues, and she specifically came up and talked to me after one of my classes and said, have you ever thought about how prior victimization and childhood experiences affect your ability to protect yourself in the future? So there's a huge connection there, and I'm so glad that Carol brought that up, because it is important for people who've had those experiences to recognize that that's part of who they are. It doesn't define them, but it is part of their past experience, and bring that into their personal protection training and plan so that they know that that can be a possibility for them.
Yeah, and I actually train businesses when I evaluate executive teams that, you need to understand something about, a person's prior history, because that might actually inform how they react or respond during a disaster. You know, I always tell clients the story, I can tell somebody who was, really severely affected because they were there or they were in New York City after 9/11, anywhere I go in the country, because no matter what you try to do, they will, if there's something going on in the building, they will absolutely evacuate. That's it. There's no discussion, no talking about it. That's what they're going to do. And that is purely from past, experience. That part of our brain that remembers that survival strategy from the first time we experienced something. So it's really interesting stuff. But Nicole, in your book, you really talk about, reasons that we deny our instinct and have to do also with, you kind of put a different spin on societal conditioning and cognitive biases. Can you explain those for us? Because I think they're really important.
Well, in the context of personal protection, the threat comes from other human beings. So we're not talking about fires and floods and things like that. We're talking about threat assessment that's based on our ability to determine whether someone intends to do us harm in some way. So we tend to choose logic to determine who poses a threat to our safety, but instinct and intuition are actually far more reliable. When we choose logic or reasoning and try to rationalize things, our thoughts become vulnerable to cognitive biases or flaws in our thinking is what those are. And those flaws in our thinking make it impossible to determine who is safe and who is dangerous. So in working with thousands of victims and survivors and hearing their stories, I was able to identify the four biases. I think there's a lot of them, but I identified four that I believe impact us the most. And the first one is called the halo effect. It occurs when we form an overall positive or negative impression of someone based on one good or bad characteristic. So to give probably the best example, and where most of the research has been focused, is that researchers continue to find that we don't believe attractive people commit crimes. So when they look at jury selection and things like that, it's really hard for us to wrap our minds around that. And so in our minds, that one good quality, in this case attractiveness, creates an overall impression that the person is good. So that's how the halo effect can impact how we determine who's safe or dangerous, if we use logic rather than intuition and instinct.
And Ted Bundy, wasn't that one of the things that they talked about with Ted Bundy, that he was actually attractive? And so women wouldn't view him as like a threat.
Yeah, attractive and charming, and yeah, absolutely. And there's statements from victims that said exactly that. So yeah, he's a perfect example, although a lot of people don't know who he is anymore. Fortunately, we do.
Oh, I didn't even think about the fact I was dating myself. God dang it.
but that's the perfect example. The second one is the association fallacy, and this is an error in thinking that causes us to assume that someone is good or safe simply because they're associated with someone or something else that we believe to be good or safe. So a real simple example of this is a friend of a friend. Well, he's a friend of a friend, so I can trust him. Or you see someone wearing scrubs and you assume that person is a doctor. Well, doctors care for people, so he must care for people and he must be safe. They're irrelevant associations that we make. And I worked a case several years ago that I think is a perfect example of this. I worked many, but this one, the victim had invited a guy from her church over for a Bible study and at her apartment, and he sexually assaulted her. Mm-hmm. And during my interview with her, she kept saying, I can't believe he did this. He goes to my church. So The point that I try to make is the fact that someone goes to your church is irrelevant in the context of threat assessment, yet this is the thinking that logic, with all of its flaws, can lead us to. And the third one is stereotyping. We all know what that is, but we know that we have a stereotypical picture of what a bad guy looks like or what the criminal or perpetrator looks like. And And it's, you know, usually the things you hear about from children all the way up to adults. That person's grungy, they're large rather than small, they're usually young. We even have some ideas about race. So when a perpetrator doesn't fit that image, that stereotypical image we have a really hard time believing that they could harm us, and that makes us vulnerable to them. And then the fourth one is a confirmation bias. So it's a tendency for us to favor information that confirms beliefs we've already formed. So it causes us to gather information kind of selectively and interpret it in a biased way. So if we form the belief, for example, that most rapists are strangers, which is the belief that a lot of people have, at least the ones that come into my classes, then we'll hang on to that belief even when there are all kinds of red flags to indicate that that person you know is dangerous, that someone in your life is dangerous. We'll ignore those things because it confirms what we already believe.
And that's a really important point. And if you have a minute, can you talk about the statistics there of, you know, stranger danger statistics?
Well, what we know is for adults, for women in particular, and it changes a little for men, but for women, about anywhere from 85% of the time, we're going to be harmed by someone that we know. So I spend a lot of time in my classes helping people wrap their minds around that, because I can teach people how to strike and kick and do all these physical things, but if they're not willing to do that to someone that they know or trusted or loved or cared about or even admired, then those skills won't help them. For kids, that statistic can rise as high as 90% to 95% of the time it's going to be someone that they know who's going to harm them. And for men, it's down somewhere around 45% to 50%, so it's a little different for them, but still a relevant factor that we need to think about. So what I want everyone to believe and remember is that how we feel about a person means far more than what we think about that person or what role they have in our lives or what position they're in or how they look or any of those things. It's how we feel about that person that matters.
Critically important, no matter who that person is. So we're going to go to break a little bit early, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about finding our voice and using sound, and again, that mind-body connection and all the ways that our instincts and intuition are really presenting themselves. So this is Pam Hill. This is Fear is Negotiable. I'm here with Carol Ward and Nicole Sundine, and we will be right back.
Stay connected.
Sign up for our newsletter.
Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, everyone. It's Pam Hill. Welcome back to Fear is Negotiable. During the break, Carol actually related a very interesting story that I've asked her to tell related to some of the cognitive biases that Nicole was just talking about. And so can you talk about that, Carol?
Sure. I was really fascinated by the four different cognitive biases that Nicole was talking about. And I was sharing that I recently delivered a TED Talk, and which is being edited, and it's going to go up on YouTube shortly, but in it, at the beginning of my TED Talk, I share a story of going against my own instinct about a situation that was then turned out to be dangerous. Not horribly dangerous, but certainly caught me off guard. And I was looking at three college students, and it went against their visual appearance, went against what I was feeling physically, like there's something wrong here. But because they were laughing and joking and they looked like, I'm using air quotes, you know, typical college kids, I, as you said earlier, Nicole, I went with my brain, not with my feeling. I felt that something was wrong, which led me into the whole study of this was, of the work I'm into, but I went with this visual association. How could these innocent college kids possibly do something wrong? This is in hindsight, and in hearing you describe these cognitive biases, I'm realizing that I went either, it was either, you know, an association fallacy or, I don't know, maybe it's some kind of stereotyping that I went against what I felt. And I think those four are really fascinating.
Really? Nicole, any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you, Carol. I think they do overlap and kind of intertwine, and I think you can probably experience maybe all four of them in one encounter with a human being. And what you're saying is what I hear from, and I'm sure both of you do too, from so many people, that these things do come into play. And when I introduced and talked about this particular section of the show, I said that we tend to choose logic and reasoning over instinct. And I say that word purposely because we do choose it. We, not only do we not connect with our instinct and intuition when it comes to, you know, identifying dangerous people, but we actually do everything we can to break it down and push it away and actually choose logic over that because it feels so wrong to go with our gut for most of us or to rely on those things. We just haven't been allowed to do that or taught to do that. And so it's a process learning to override that. Even for those of us with experience, I definitely don't come from a platform of perfection with this. I learn every day. And sometimes I have to be reminded that I'm not listening to those things, that I'm choosing logic or reasoning. So it's a process, and I think we get better every day of our lives, especially those of us who work towards that and try to get better in that arena. But makes total sense what you're saying, Carol. Mm-hmm.
And I have to wonder sometimes, too, if stereotyping doesn't kind of work both ways. It's like, you know, I'm on the, you know, the Metra and somebody gets on and I think, that person doesn't look right, you know. And then, of course, the first thing I start doing is going, is that because they have a hoodie on? You know, is that because they're dressed a certain way or because they look a certain way or their, you know, hair isn't clean or something like that? So, I know I've said this many times, but in the age of political correctness, I think that we stereotype we believe a bad guy looks like, but we also can override our own instinct about somebody, our gut reaction about somebody, thinking, I just stereotype that guy because he's dressed a certain way and I can't do that. So, and I've heard that from people in businesses. So I always thought that was kind of an interesting, you know, thing how, I agree with political correctness, but I think it's also, you know, plays to our disadvantage sometimes, because it disconnects us from that intuitive feeling that we get about people. So, Carol, one of the things I enjoyed the most in your book are the tools to really strengthen that mind-body connection by proactively working to connect to your senses. I think the section on the sound and voice is so critical because that is, to my mind, really at the heart of why a lot of people, and especially young women, are victimized. They simply can't find their voice. And I know a lot of people even have, this is one of the primary nightmares, I think especially that women have, that they're being victimized and they literally can't scream. So can you please talk about sound and voice as an aspect of getting in touch with your intuition?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. You know, I will have people in my practice who I will work with them to try to speak up more. And sometimes when they first start, and this can be, you know, involving role play and just, you know, tell me how you feel, speak it out. They'll think they're shouting, but they actually have the quietest voice possible. And I think people think that they have to go from having no voice to a really loud voice and be able to say no and assert themselves right out of the gate. And that's not really true. We have to train ourselves and get ourselves used to our own voices. And that's why I describe exercises where I have people sing or practice speaking out loud in safe places. You don't have to go from having never said no to shouting out no. You can start to get used to the sound of your own voice. I have people, I'll say to them, I want you to sing while you're vacuuming so that you don't get embarrassed by your own voice or think that you're too loud. Or if the car, I want you to turn up the radio and start singing or talking in the safety where no one can hear you, just to get used to what you really sound like and to realize that it's okay. You're not going to be yelled at or scolded for speaking up and speaking out. So it serves a dual purpose, getting used to the sound of your own voice and getting your voice out there in ways that are fun.
And one of the important points, this isn't really about personal safety, but I just think it's important to make, is that speaking up can help you reclaim or let go of areas in your life that are no longer necessary. I just think that's a really important thing to know as well.
It's really true. It's funny. I always say the more you can learn to say no, the more it allows you to say yes when you want to. Because sometimes if you've been trained to be a good girl, you're accommodating, you say yes when you don't want to, you don't know how to speak up for yourself. But the more you can learn to say no and set boundaries, and no's can simply mean, it doesn't have to be the word no, it can be a phrase like, that doesn't work for me, or it's not the right time. There are a whole bunch of different phrases that you can work with that set a boundary, then allows you to think about whether or not you really want to do that thing that you've been asked to do. And then you don't become a habitual yes person who then becomes overwhelmed, who then becomes stressed. And as we talked about, the more stressed we are, the more we disconnect from who we are and what we feel.
And there's nobody angrier in the world than a certified people pleaser.
That's right.
As a recovering one myself, I can tell you that. Nicole, in your trainings, walk us through how you work with women and girls about finding their voice, to set boundaries, not just to say, no in certain circumstances, but to set boundaries and maintain control of a situation.
Well, I talk to girls and women about the fact that anytime somebody doesn't hear the word no, it means they're trying to control you, which should be recognized as a possible threat, but typically isn't. People have a hard time with this. So we spend some time in my class, not as much time as I'd like, because we have to cover so many other aspects of personal protection, but we do talk about it. And Pam, you and I both like the way that Gavin De Becker describes the cultural and societal kind of aspects of this concept. He says that when a man says no in this culture, it's the end of a discussion. And when a woman says no, it's the beginning of a negotiation. And I think that's pretty profound. I think that it's true to an extent, and something that we all need to think about, those of us who are women in our society need to think about. But when I work through seminars and my scenarios about interpersonal protection, which is kind of what we're talking about here, it's very rare for me to find a woman, and even more rare to find a girl who has a healthy relationship with the word no. Most of us have a lot of trouble with it. And it's for the reasons that Carol described, things like social and gender conditioning, embarrassment, and the fear of being rude. Those can't be dismissed as a huge part of why we don't protect ourselves. They come up in every single class I teach. Without me bringing them up, they always come up. It's a huge issue for girls and women to work through. And most of them need more time working through it than I have in my classes. So I'm definitely going to start letting them know about Carol. Because I think spending that time
woman.
But I teach that whole series of interpersonal safety strategies that, you know, talks about options and ways to say no and how you can be comfortable with it. And we can't cover all those today, but I just want to start by encouraging listeners who maybe have some trouble, which is most of us, with the word no, and I want you to just give one question some thought. Why is it that you consider saying no to be rude? I want people to think about that a little bit. The word no is embedded in our language to help us enforce boundaries. So if we want to be true to ourselves, we should consider thinking of no as a good word, kind of a protective word, rather than a bad or negative word or a word that's rude. And that's something to just start with, and then we can work from there on that. But just in the context of today's show, I think that's a good place to start.
And it is equally important with a stranger as a family member, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. These words, anytime we're thinking about personal protection, we need to open our minds to the fact that it can be anyone we're talking to or protecting ourselves from, and we always need to have our minds open to that.
Okay. Yeah, and I think this, going back, I know, Nicole, we've talked about this numerous times about the mental rehearsal and making sure that we're getting in touch with not just the physical strategies of fighting back, but also using our voice as part of that mental rehearsal.
Yeah, agreed. It's like I said, I think I wish I could spend more time on this in my seminars, but I think people like Carol are a great source of actually helping people work through this stuff on a, maybe a more individual level even with, we're all unique in the reasons why we have trouble with certain things, and so having someone help you through that, or maybe getting her book and, you know, reading through some of her ways of doing it might really help people.
Carol,
appreciate that. Any thoughts?
I wanted to say, you know, I'm thinking of an exercise. I was thinking of an exercise that I did in a group that had to do with, it's called drawing a line in the sand. And one person will stand and say, this is the line. And then usually with someone they feel safe with, it could be me or another participant in the group, the person who's drawn the line in the sand will stand there, and then the other person will start to walk toward them. And the person who's drawn the line in the sand, it's so fascinating, will say, don't come any closer. And they know instinctively when they've reached the edge of what feels safe and what doesn't, and it's an absolute golden rule that once the person is told to not come any closer, they have to stop. And the person who's drawn the line in the sand gets to experience what it's like, whether they're speaking loudly or softly, to have someone respect their boundaries. And it starts to build up this innate sense within them that they know when someone has crossed a line. It's so wonderful to watch, and I'm just thinking of that it's a way of saying no.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds like a great exercise.
I agree 100%. I think that's great. And the more of those kind of things we can do, the more prepared we're going to be when someone doesn't respect that.
Yeah.
But you're right, we have to know what it feels like to have our wishes be respected first, and sometimes that's kind of blurry for a lot of us.
Yeah.
Nicole, just out of curiosity, when you're doing your trainings, and I know that the only part of the training is actually the fight back part of it, but do you have the girls and the women vocalize towards the attacker? Is that part of the training?
Yeah, always. It's important for so many different reasons. I mean, we want to let people know what we want them to do. If we want them to back away from us, if we want them to leave us alone, if we want them to get their hands off of us or whatever, we need to be telling them what we expect from them. And following up with evasive, you know, actions, escape and running away, or physical if they won't let go of us and we can't escape. So that's part of all of it. And it accomplishes a lot of things. I mean, it is empowering to use our voice. Like Carol said, it's something that's a big piece of it. It lets people around us know what's going on. There's a lot of important pieces to that. So that's always part of the physical training.
And just to, you know, again, getting back to the senses and our instinct and our intuition, just, Nicole, from a purely threat assessment perspective, do you think the fact that we now communicate with Facebook, Twitter, text, email, has literally changed our senses' ability to properly perceive threats? I mean, we are visual creatures, we're auditory creatures, but now we spend most of our time really communicating without some of these great allies. I mean, on some level, has this retarded our ability to simply perceive threats?
I think there's no doubt about that. I think it has. And besides the fact that I believe that less face-to-face communication is negatively impacting our ability to read people in general, I mean, I think we're losing those skills overall because we're doing it less and less. But when we communicate through technology, especially using only the written words, so texting and emails and social networking and things like that, we aren't able to hear those vocal nuances or read the facial expressions and the body language that help us detect danger. So really, as a way of life, I recommend that any time any of our senses are compromised, I mean, if we have headphones on, our hearing's compromised, we need to be more aware and compensate for that in some way. And so same thing with communicating through technology. We need to be aware of that and be more cautious with people, and we need to compensate in some way. Maybe that's asking more questions. Maybe that's asking for, I don't know, a conversation over Skype where you can see that person's face or whatever it may be, but we need to compensate in some way anytime any of our senses are compromised. So that's just something that I teach in a general level, but it definitely applies to the technology that we're using to communicate nowadays. No doubt about it, it's affecting things.
Yeah, right, absolutely. And it's not because we're of a certain age either that we're saying this.
No.
We need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have Carol actually walk us through a few exercises. So this is Pam Hill of Fear is Negotiable. I'm here with Carol Ward and Nicole Sundine, and we will be right back.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN.
From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Fear is Negotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter at Fear is Negotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hello, everyone. This is Pam Hill, and welcome back to Fear is Negotiable. I'm here with Carol Ward and Nicole Sundine, and we are talking about instinct and intuition and how to use it for our personal safety. Much of instinct or intuition is really based upon experience. That's just a fact. So let's I'd like to start with you, Carol. Let's start talking about how we can train people of any age to get in touch with our instinct and our intuition.
Well, I really believe in helping people use their bodies and really reconnect to the body, because it is a reconnection. We walk around with these bodies. It's just that sometimes we forget that there's a very, very big primal connection. And I'll have people say to me, well, I don't know how to get in touch with my instinct or intuition. I don't feel things. And I'll say, well, let's actually look at that and try a simple exercise. And your listeners can try this as well. And the exercise is called Good Feelings, Bad Feelings, and it's to help you remember that you actually know what feels good to you and what feels bad to you. So I'll have people, and your listeners can do this right now, I'll have people focus on the good things in their life, somebody that they love, a favorite food, a favorite place to visit. And as you bring that person or that food or that place up into your mind's eye and you imagine yourself being with them or eating that food or being in that place, to notice how your body's reacting. Just to take a quick scan. And I would say 9 times out of 10 people have a reaction. It could be faint, but there is a reaction. And just to simply start to notice that. And this is an exercise you can do every day. And then I want people to switch over to things that don't make them feel so good, that last boss that didn't make them feel good, or that food that when someone brings it to you, you're like, oh, I can't stand that, or a cold, rainy day that doesn't particularly lift your spirits. And again, as you bring all those images to mind, that person, that icky food, that cold, rainy day, notice how your body feels, your tenseness in the shoulders or stomach, whatever it is. And if you do this exercise daily, going back and forth between what feels good and what feels bad for a couple of minutes every day, and then write down where you feel those sensations, the next time you're in a situation and your good feeling place kicks in, you'll notice, you'll be able to remember, oh, this is a good thing. Or if your bad feelings and sensations kick in, you can say, huh, this usually indicates to me that this isn't a good thing. Let me pay attention to that. That's all we're asking. Just paying attention and noticing what you feel and figuring it out with a little bit of time.
And that goes really perfectly to that concept of kind of quieting things down around you.
Yes.
That, you know, those messages are really there. It's just a matter of you getting that noise quieted down enough to be able to actually listen to them. Other exercises that you can think of that are in the book? There are so many in the book. You really have to buy the book, everyone, to get all of these. But, Carol, can you think of anything else that As far as exercises go?
Yeah, there's another one that's my favorite. It's called Find Your True North, and I believe that the more we can wake up our sensations, all the ones that we already have available to us, the more that we can enliven our bodies, and the more our bodies are enlivened, the more we can have that radar about what feels good and what feels bad. And I have a whole exercise where I have people really focus in on each of their senses. You know, imagine listening to beautiful music, using your eyes to visualize and picture things that are beautiful and lovely. Imagine yourself tasting certain foods, or using touch to waken up and help you remember that how tactile we are as human beings. And I have people go through working with the five senses and noticing which one is the strongest, because sometimes that's the one that's going to tip us off the fastest. There was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal about scent and how we perceive so much through scent, and how that might be for you your strongest intuitive thing, that you pick up something just smells wrong to you, even if there's nothing visually off. And to start using this sense exercise called Find Your True North to help you remember and to help you realize what is your strongest sensation, and to start strengthening that.
And that's critically important. And Nicole, I can't recall which Dave Grossman book, but Nicole and I are both huge fans of it. They're written primarily for law enforcement and military, but they are fabulous books in terms of teaching you how your body will respond during an emergency. And I think it's the Mental Toughness book, the Skills for the Nation Peacekeeper book, that actually talks about how these senses sort of come in and go out depending upon the circumstances that you're in. So, for instance, you know, we're very visual creatures. During the day, when a threat presents itself, the first thing we do is we freeze, we turn into the threat, because we're visual creatures and we're looking to get, that's the easiest way for us to capture information. But at night, what will happen is that that peripheral vision will go away, you know, possibly at night, but what will happen is that instead of losing your hearing will actually become, you know, much more heightened. And Nicole, I can't recall, I know you've read all those books as well, you know, which book it is, but any thoughts on that? I think that's really interesting, Carol, what you're saying. It's definitely what they found in all these books.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm not sure which book it is either, but I know I talk a little bit about it in mine. I just can't remember which book I referenced. But it goes back to this whole idea that we are designed to protect ourselves. Our bodies are designed. We're physiologically, physically, and psychologically, and probably a bunch of other, you know, aspects. We're designed for protection. And that's something that we all need to be aware of, that our body's going to do those things. It's going to use the senses in a way that's going to collect the information we need to be safe. And we can count on that. That's something that just happens. We don't have to work very hard at doing that. Now, when you do sense a threat, especially when instinct kicks in and you sense a threat, but you're not sure where it's coming from or who it's coming from, that's the time that we want to enable our senses so we can help them out by making sure that we're using our vision to scan and we can actually make it better. But we can trust that they're going to do the job that they're intended to do.
Yeah, and I suppose it's not really significantly different from when a person loses their vision. You know, their hearing and sense of touch get a lot more heightened. So I suppose it's all, you know, kind of in the same vein. Just absolutely fascinating stuff. In your trainings, Nicole, how do you talk with people about listening to and honing intuition specifically?
Well, I do training for women, but I also do a lot of training for younger people. And one of the things that I believe is, as we get older, most of us learn more about trusting instinct and intuition, because unfortunately we've had to learn the hard way what happens when we don't, when we resort to logic or when we just don't listen. We've learned the hard way. So when I teach young people how to connect with their instinct and intuition and use it to their benefit in relation to personal safety, I guess what I'm really trying to do is speed up that process for them if I can, and bridge that gap so that maybe they don't have to learn the hard way like we did. And I think that's a lot of what education is about. So it's not just enough to say listen to your gut or trust your inner voice when you're talking with people, young or older, without providing any detail about how to actually do that. And I think we've accomplished a lot of that today. We've given them actual things that they can do to make that connection, to use these mechanisms to their advantage. And I think there's a lot more that people can learn about it. I know we're all interested and we're always learning more. So I encourage people to do the exercises like Carol described. I'll definitely send them her way to do more of those types of things. And then I also teach some really practical strategies that sort of promote the functioning of instinct and intuition, since we tend to kind of press it down and not pay attention to it. And, you know, I basically talk to them about resisting the urge to reason. I talk with them about stop the cluttering and clear your mind of things, which is a lot of what Carol talked about, too. You know, minimize distractions when your safety is at risk and, you know, key in on those things. And then stop wavering and start taking action. And I think Carol touched on this a little bit, too. But what I ask people to do is the next time they get the feeling that something isn't right, that they stop what they're doing and focus on it, that's where the biggest mistakes are made, that we push it away, that we're in a hurry, that we don't pay attention to it. So once you do that, the initial action you take to ensure your safety, maybe as simple as just asking some more questions or ending a conversation or taking another route, or they may be as complex as running or physically fighting back. But in most situations, even taking the wrong action based on instinct and intuition is better than doing nothing at all. So if you avoid the danger completely by taking instinctive and intuitive action, no additional thought is going to be required. You may not even know you avoided that threat. But if you're not able to avoid the danger in the early stages of the encounter, there will be time to integrate logic as the encounter progresses. So for those of you who really believe in thinking and need to think things through, you know that there's a time for thinking in the process of personal protection, but try to resist going to that initially. That's kind of the message that I try to send everyone.
And that's fantastic. And for crying out loud, stop drinking too much and taking drugs when you're around other people, because your instincts and intuition are not helping you when you are, you know, drinking or taking drugs. So we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to make sure that Carol and Nicole both have a lot of time to talk about how to get in touch with them. So first, thank you so much for such a wonderful and important session. Carol, how do we get in touch with you? How do we get to your website, et cetera?
I'm happy to give that information. I just want to say, as an enthusiastic guest, I thought this was a really great conversation and so much information that Nicole gave and you gave, Pam. I think it's really important information. It all works together in a very intuitive level, I have to say. People can find my website. It's Carol with a K, K-A-R-O-L-W-A-R-D, carolward.com. I have books on my website. I also just released a CD, or you can get the download audio files, where you can start working with visualization and helping your body get primed to make the best choices for you. So these are a whole bunch of exercises that are done through visualization that help you decide what feels right, what feels wrong, how to calm down. Very short, specific visualizations. I wanted them to be short because people are very busy and don't often have the time to do 15-minute visualizations. And my TED Talk will be posted in the next week, so people will be able to access that as well at carolward.com.
And Nicole can be found at realisticsafetysolutions.com. And I apologize, we're completely out of time. Just join us next week. And remember, fear is negotiable, but only through planning, training, and preparation. Thank you very much, listeners, and Carol and Nicole.
Thank you for joining us this week for Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. We hope you'll tune in again next Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time for another edition with host Pamela Hill on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll identify more of the best practices in business survival then.
The information and ideas presented on this show are for informational purposes only. Please consult a business continuity, security, or disaster recovery professional before implementing any plans or ideas discussed on this show. The implementation of any protocol is at the sole discretion and responsibility of our listeners.